Hello, everyone. This is Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success Magazine and the host for today's event. Welcome to our live webinar, Come One, Come All, Smart Strategies for Multi-Channel Donor Acquisition, sponsored by InfoGroup Nonprofit Solutions. Buzzwords don't get any buzzier than multi-channel in regard to fundraising, but let's not forget that good old direct mail is a channel, too, and not just a channel, but the channel when it comes to bringing in the cash. Today, we'll explore a multi-channel approach to acquisition that includes a healthy dose of direct mail. Before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Ask a Question box. You can also use the Ask a Question box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions during, more likely at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets and bells and whistles on the console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on the console do and how you can customize your experience today. Okay, with that out of the way, let's meet our speakers. With us today are Karen Kirchhoff, Vice President of Mindset Direct, and Larry May, Senior Vice President, for Strategic Development at InfoGroup Nonprofit Solutions. Welcome, both of you. And Larry, why don't you kick things off?
Great. Thank you, Margaret. I'm going to talk a little today about what's happening in multi-channel acquisition for a lot of the larger nonprofit mailers we work with. And I want to just offer a couple of kind of disclaimers to start off with. I am going to be talking about large organizations with big budgets and big donor files, but I think it's important for folks to remember that, you know, even if you're a smaller organization, I would hope that you would not get caught up in thinking, well, he's talking about big organizations, we can't do those things, because really the concepts are applicable, big or small, and whether you're talking with 1,000 people or 1,000,000 people, you're really talking to one at a time, okay? So try to keep that as a perspective if you would. So what's happening right now? One of the first things I'd like to tell you is, if you're not raising a lot of money on digital media, don't feel bad, because almost no one really is. And, you know, we know some things or think some things are currently happening, like mail is less important than it used to be. A lot of us are banking and reading our newspapers, et cetera, without the newspaper any longer. A lot of folks think, well, the older audience is dying off and getting smaller, and donors are moving to digital means as a preferred way to make gifts. And some of this is true, and some of it is not so true. Mail is very definitely less important, and we all know that the Postal Service is in trouble. But the older audience, for example, is not shrinking, and people still prefer direct marketing donors, still prefer to make their gifts by mail, and in fact, they prefer to do them with checks. The majority of donors respond primarily to the mail versus digital. They like to use checks, as I just said, and really only a few nonprofits, and generally fairly small ones, are dominantly raising the funds they need via the web or other social media, et cetera. So let's just take a little bit of look at what some large nonprofits are doing digitally. Nonprofits have put a lot of effort into this, as you can imagine, and for more than 10 years, it's been very important a subject throughout nonprofit organizations to put a lot of effort into what they're doing first on websites, then email, and now in social media such as primarily Facebook and to some extent Twitter. Social media is fairly new, but it's getting a lot of attention, a lot of staff time, and a lot of effort. And the new media are still primarily focused on promoting the mission of the organization as compared to fundraising. So if you look at a typical organization's webpage, for example, website, you'll see that much more time and real estate is dedicated to the mission of the organization than to fundraising, which is, I think, of course, quite appropriate. Here's some numbers to just take a quick look at. I popped these off the Facebook sites of these organizations in the last few days. And you can see some organizations have, you know, fairly small numbers of Facebook friends, others quite a few. And I think this is a real good example. Take a look at DAV, for example. That's the Disabled American Veterans, 2 million friends on Facebook. I can tell you they're raising virtually no money through Facebook, but they have lots and lots of people following them. And lots of those folks are going to be the friends, relatives, et cetera, and veterans themselves going there for information. Same numbers for some organizations on Twitter. UNICEF. I mean, UNICEF has, what, perhaps 100,000 to 300,000 actual contributors, and they've got well over a million Twitter followers. Look at the bottom one there, Greenpeace. They are very aggressive on Twitter. You get a tweet from them at least once a day. And I can tell you, they just told me last week that they have not figured out how to raise money using Twitter as a device. I'll reinforce it. Most make little or no money from Facebook or Twitter. Just to take a quick look at a few large organizations I have the good fortune to work with, and these are they. They're all big organizations with big direct marketing and well-established direct marketing programs. And I'll tell you a little bit about what they're doing in digital and multi-channel marketing. Using multi-channel to promote events has become extremely effective. And it's really kind of the friend get a friend, you know, I'm walking for March of Dimes this weekend, will you support me kind of thing. And whereas that might have been somebody asking their neighbor or asking at the office, it's really become a digital function to a very great degree now. And it's extremely effective. The volunteer sends emails to his friends, the friends click through to the web page and make a pledge or a direct contribution. The numbers are very strong, and the people you gain are good prospects to convert to other forms of giving as well. But you have to really think of them as prospects. Someone who's participated in an event or who has sponsored someone else who participated in an event is a prospect to convert into direct marketing contributing long term. And you need to do everything you possibly can to preferably get their postal address, but at the very minimum get their email address from which you can discover postal for many of them. Here's March of Dimes, for example. Their Walk March for Babies is a huge annual event. The average walker, 300,000 walkers in a typical year, has 3 to 4 donors supporting them on average. You know, you can imagine that's for some folks 1 and for some folks 50, right? They raise well over $100 million doing it, and the online tool is becoming more and more important as part of it. So, for example, you might get an email like this, which I did, from a friend of mine who happens to work at March of Dimes, asking me to support her when she marched for babies. At the end of the email message are some links you can click on, and when you do, you fall onto a landing page, and you can see the prominent buttons there, Donate Now or Walk With Me, and that moves you towards supporting the organization via your friend who's asked you to support him or her. Sloan Kettering does something very similar with an annual cycle for survival, and they promote it on Facebook, Twitter, through email, on YouTube, on their website, etc. And they do very, very well with it, 40,000 donors in a typical year. And it, there you can see a picture of what, on a web page, the cycle for survival. That's the thermometer, traditional concept of the thermometer for this particular participant in the cycle. But digital is still a small part of these organizations' ongoing direct response revenue channels. And those are the actual numbers for these organizations. And what I'm doing here is I'm looking at their total direct response, not event, direct response, ongoing year-in, year-out support, and what percentage of that is actually coming through digital channels, and that's primarily through a person going directly to the website. And you can see at most it's 5%. So DAV there, Disabled American Veterans, 2 million people following them on Twitter, yet only 5% of their revenue is coming through any digital means at all. So it's trending up, but it's slow. The interesting thing here is that these organizations all report that of that 5% or so of their revenue that comes through digital means, 80% of it, 4 of the 5, if you will, is coming to the website immediately after the direct mail pieces go out. So it's working primarily as a collection box, if you will. It's an increasingly important way to communicate. There's a great value to having multi-channel communication with any of your donors, and wherever you can, you should, because donors who you are reaching through multiple channels will be more valuable to you in time, primarily because when they're responding via a digital channel, they are using a credit card, and therefore their gift will be greater. Now, is this because our donors are old? You know, sometimes folks will say, well, Larry, you're talking about Boys Town. Those donors are all old. Or you're talking about March of Dimes, those donors are all old. Well, are they really? After doing this for 30 years, I recently stopped and looked at these numbers for the first time and thought, duh, Larry, you should have done this a long time ago. But I was really amazed to find that in a wide variety of organizations, I had many more I could show, a third or more of the donors are actually under 65 years old. And if you consider what that means someone who is still working, probably extremely computer literate, probably on email all day long. And they are generally younger than we think, so I don't think that is what's driving the continued interest and success of direct mail. People like to write checks. About 5% of contributions to most organizations come via credit card, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. And that number hasn't changed much in a long time. People like to write checks to nonprofit organizations. And I'll give you an example of something to consider. A typical organization of the sort I'm talking about will mail not only donor files, they'll also mail catalog files and magazine files. Every single person who purchased from that catalog file used a credit card to make the purchase. Yet when they contribute to the organization, again, 90-plus percent of them will write a check. It's just something Americans like to do. So where are we today in direct mail? I want to get on the direct mail topic for a little bit. It's a real challenging time. We've got low response rates, particularly since 2008, when the current downturn in the economy, if you will, began. So what happens? Nonprofits mail less. And when they mail less, they're doing less acquisition, so their house files get smaller. And when they do, they focus on exchanging with one another. And that means that there are more dupes on the list that they're mailing, and that they're mailing more pieces to the same people. And as a result, the response rate goes down. It's kind of a tough circle we're stuck in. So you've probably heard and read some stories about big data over the last several years. It's a big topic. And it's the truth. We know an awful lot about an awful lot of Americans, and there are now advantages in this for nonprofit organizations who can access this data and do a lot of interesting things with it. We're not talking about violating anyone's privacy or stealing anyone's identity. What we're talking about is trying to help the nonprofit organization make better use of their budgets. And thanks to co-ops in particular, there's a great deal of transactional data available now. You know, for my whole career, there's been demographic data available where we could ask ourselves, how old are these people? What is their home probably worth? Etc. And a lot of that data is derived from the census, and a lot of it makes assumptions about neighborhoods in which we assume that people who live in the same neighborhood tend to be the same. And of course they're not. I think all of us would know that, you know, the little old lady next door might not earn as much as we do, but she might also have four times as much disposable income as we do. So what's happened now is we've really got data on transactions, on catalog purchases, and on giving that we can put to use in our direct marketing programs, both direct mail and any form of digital, to enhance the performance. For example, in co-ops, which you may have heard about, I listed the names of some of them at the bottom of this slide, members contribute data. Catalogs have been doing this for over 15 years, and nonprofits have been doing it for several years as well. And as a result, each of these co-ops, cooperatives is what that means, have transactional data on tens of millions of people, you know, typically 30 to 40 million individuals with giving history of where they have given, organized by the type of organization they've given to. You can't go in here and say, I want somebody who gave to Greenpeace, but you can have a model built that will focus on donors who look most like your donors and are most likely to respond to you. We can sometimes take this information and do very interesting things with it, such as targeting high-dollar people with a higher ask, or looking for sustainers who might be willing to give a monthly gift, or just using it as a lower-cost source of prospect data than many of the lists that we might be renting currently for a client. Merge optimization is a very interesting concept, and fundamentally what it's talking about is taking this transactional data, all these transactions of catalog purchases, retail purchases, web purchases, giving activity, and overlaying it on the prospect universe or lapsed donors or any group of names that we wish to mail to determine who are the most likely and least likely responders. You can do it to the entire output of the merge, and these things have become really quite affordable. This was kind of like a pipe dream earlier in my time in the business. But, you know, now that your phone has as much memory as, you know, the mainframe we used to work with has, it's relatively quick, easy, and somewhat inexpensive to do this kind of data manipulation. So what are the benefits of this kind of optimization? You can avoid the poorest performers. A typical thing that organizations will do is perhaps drop the lowest 10 or 15% of people who look most unlikely to support the organization. You can go deeper into the successful list. So, for example, if you're exchanging with 10 other organizations and you're using their six-month $10-plus donors, you might be able to model into their older donors and find pockets that will work very well. And, you know, I'd really like to suggest to folks that, you know, there's an old concept of mailing smarter. I think that mailing smarter is not smart if what it is mailing less. What it really should be is finding ways to target the dollars you've got at your disposal more effectively. Do everything you can to get postal addresses and at least email addresses, because, you know, when you're simply saying, folks, here's some interesting stories about what our organization is doing, you're depending on them to seek you out. What you really need to be doing is pushing a message to them that comes and knocks on their door and says, we need you to help our organization. And the most effective way to do that for nonprofits today is still direct mail. You can offer incentives such as a premium, you know, the old idea of the tote bag when you give to PBS. Well, how about if you go on to our website and give us your postal address, we'll mail you a premium. It's a great way to get the address of the person. Updates, online information such as, can we send you our newsletter that'll show you where your dollars are going to work. A lot of people will take you up on that and will give you their email address and hopefully also give you their postal address. If you're doing premiums now, consider the idea of having two premiums if they contribute to you online. It's a great way to convert a direct mail person into a digital donor as well, which, as I said earlier, will mean a longer long-term value. And even, you know, you can append postal addresses to records where you only have emails. There are services out there now where 25 or 35% of the email addresses you've got, a vendor can find a postal address for you. You can even do that with Facebook and Twitter identifications. The data for modeling digital prospects, for example, I was just at a presentation at the Bridge Conference in Washington 2 weeks ago, and Sierra Club was talking about the success they've had at converting their email activists. So these are people who they've gotten to sign petitions at places like Care2, for example, to convert to donating, by using telemarketing. And they pointed out, and this is exactly my experience as well, you need to do these things quickly when people have first joined you. The conversion could be pretty high if you're telemarketing them, but it's also going to be expensive. And it's really important, as I said earlier, to think about this as prospecting. You know, folks who have simply given you, who followed you on Facebook or are following you on Twitter or friended you, whatever, they really are not donors, and you can't think of them as donors. You need to think of them as prospects. Reactivation is, I think, another thing that people pay far too little attention to. But it's extremely important that you think of your lapsed donors as another form of prospects. You know, most donors, if asked, you know, even if they haven't given to you in a year or two, do you give to the XYZ organization in surveys, they say, yes, I do. They don't really realize that they're lapsed or they're active. And I know, of course, the performance is much different. But give these folks the benefit of the doubt. You can use a lot of this transactional data to go very deep into a lapsed file and find people who may not have made a gift to your organization for 10 or 15 years even, but who are active elsewhere, who are giving elsewhere, and who are good prospects for you to reactivate. Here's an example of what for one organization, the value of a reactivated lapsed donor versus a new donor. So this organization in 2005 picked up 258,000 new donors and reactivated 103,000 donors. And after six years, the value per donor for the news was $80, and for the reactivated lapses was $108. So it's a 35% better performance on a lapsed reactivation than on a new donor acquisition. So don't overlook the importance of reactivating lapsed donors. I just want to throw a couple of creative ideas at you lately that folks have been talking about. They're old ideas, but they're hip again, and one of them is putting an actual coin on your mail package. That's an actual dime there on this March of Dimes package. It's an old idea. I was seeing it in the 80s when I started, when I was actually a fairly young guy. And March of Dimes is succeeding with a dime, no surprise, right? It can lift response by as much as 50%. And you should say something clever in the copy about, you know, the old line used to be, we sent you these 2 cents to get your attention and to hear your opinion or something of that sort. Another old idea that's new again is matching gifts. We all know a lot about matching gifts. If you listen to NPR, that's all they do is matching gifts. It is also an old idea. The old packages used to have two dummy checks in them, one for $10 and one for $15. And the copy would say, when you make your gift, return the check that matches your gift, either $10, $15, or send them both and send $25. You do something clever like that, and you can get the match from either board members, from major donors, from your general fund, somewhere. But you don't need a lot of money pledged to the match either. It can be a fairly small amount of money. High-velocity people are calling these packages. These are the kinds of things that you see and can't believe someone has sent you, such as blankets, gloves, calculators, slippers, amazing things, boxes full of pens and greeting cards and what have you. They've been around for many years, but the use of them is growing and becoming more and more popular. They're generally produced overseas, usually in China. You get a very high response rate. Some folks are reporting lower long-term value than even donors who were acquired with more standard premiums, such as name labels or greeting cards, for example. And there's some evidence they may work better with slightly younger donors, and by younger I mean perhaps 60 and under. Conversion is really critical. There's no point in acquiring a donor if you can't convert them. The old saw was 50% will never give a second time. I generally see the number to be better than 50%, but it's not a lot better than 50%. The sooner you get the second gift, the better off you will be. You can use telemarketing to promote sustainers, for example, and this is a great idea that our colleague Lori O'Brien shared, and unfortunately Lori was not able to join us today due to a funeral that she had to attend. But you can go to donors who have just made their first gift to you and ask them if they'd consider, by phone, ask them if they'd consider becoming monthly supporters, and you'd be amazed at the percentage that will, particularly if they are that small percentage of credit card donors. And the longer it takes you to convert to the second gift, the lower your LTV will be, so do that immediately. One great idea is to send the same package to new donors that they just received and responded to. I know that sounds stupid, but we've been in a lot of situations. The first time this happened, it was by mistake. We mail a group of donors who are just acquired, let's say with a name label package or with a card package, whatever, or a straight letter. Send them the identical package within a few months, and you will generally, not everyone, but generally, get an amazing response, sometimes 20% or better, immediately converted to second gift. And consider that that acquisition package should not be, you know, the Lone Ranger that all it does is acquire donors for you. The donors being acquired with a package have indicated they love that package. That's why they responded. Try making it part of your regular renewal cycle with slightly different copy if you wish, but sometimes that's not even important. So just to summarize, digital is a small portion of what's going on in direct response for most of the organizations I have the opportunity to speak with. It's hugely important for engaging, cultivating, for brand development, particularly with younger people who, although they may not be anywhere near the age to start giving to you, will become aware of you. Do everything you possibly can to get postal addresses because that is the best way to start promoting to those people, thinking about them like acquisition as you attempt to convert them into your regular direct response program. And the big new idea that's really working in direct mail and other forms of direct response is data. There's a lot of data. You can access it. It's relatively inexpensive. You should be asking folks about how you can do that. Thanks very much. I appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you so much, Larry.
My pleasure.
Everybody. This is Karen Kirchhoff, as Margaret said at the top of the call, and with Mindset Direct. I've been doing sort of this, direct response, for really more than 20 years at this point. And while I love mail, I got my start in telemarketing. So, you know, as I always like to say, I heart mail, but I also heart telemarketing and mobile and even online. I spent a couple of years at AOL back in the day and got my taste of the digital space. So I was really excited to see Larry spending a good amount of time talking about mail and talking about what he sees happening in digital. I think that he's right on. I'm going to spend a little bit of time right off the bat talking about what I think many folks consider to be the ugly redheaded stepchild of fundraising and even acquisition, and that is telemarketing. I, as I mentioned, got my start in telemarketing, so I happen to love it as a channel. And, you know, the key question I think for a lot of folks is, you know, do we call or do we not call? Back in the 70s and 80s, Larry was talking about penny packages and nickel packages, while telemarketing was a pretty popular channel back then as well. And then it really fell out of favor, I think largely for a number of reasons. Number one on the slide here you can see is that there are really very few lists available to use in acquisition, use telemarketing in acquisition. And then on top of that, new telemarketing regulations over the past 15 years or so have limited our ability to contact folks. The things like caller ID make it more difficult to contact folks. So it has become a much less effective channel in acquisition, in sort of cold acquisition. Warm prospects, however, though, as Larry mentioned, tend to show a fair amount of promise. And I'll talk about some examples of where we've seen success in phoning those online activists, petition signers, those sort of folks who've raised their hand in a sense, but may not have yet made a donation. Smart marketers know that telemarketing is still an incredibly valuable channel for house file strategies, including the warm prospects. But for lapsed reactivation, sustainer recruitment, renewals, special appeals, emergency appeals, that kind of thing. The key really to making it work, though, is segmentation. And that's why I think it's so important that Larry spent a chunk of time talking about the data strategies, this big data, the usage of credit card, online activity, all of that really underscores somebody's relationship with an organization and their likelihood to make another gift, convert to a sustainer, reinstate their support, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a couple of minutes. Telemarketing for a long time was also considered a standalone channel, but it really doesn't stand alone anymore. Strategically integrated into a direct response program, it will absolutely drive longer-term value, improve retention, and interestingly give you that one-to-one feedback from your donors and constituents that's a lot harder to get when your primary channel of communication is mail. Telemarketing is a great two-way communication channel and something that it can often be overlooked when organizations are considering whether or not to use the phones in their fundraising programs. When I started talking, I was sharing with you all the things that I love, telemarketing, direct mail, email. Really what I love is data. And mostly because good creative or good messaging is nice, and obviously that's an important part of any successful program, but if you aren't measuring your results, if you aren't doing all that strategic segmentation, if you aren't targeting the right people, all of that good creative is totally wasted. So what you're looking at right here is a comparison of the value of a direct mail reinstated donor compared to the value of a telemarketing reinstated donor. The grid up top with the orange is the mail folks. The grid down at the bottom with the purple header are the telemarketing reinstated folks. And what this is looking at is their value at several different points in time. This is a large national organization, by the way. And so you see value 6, value 12, value 18, value 24. That's essentially their value to the organization at that point in their life cycle. And you can see in the little starburst down at the bottom of each of the grids that the average 24-month value of a direct mail reinstated donor is a little bit more than half the value of a telemarketing reinstated donor. So the point here is that telemarketing can be an incredibly valuable channel when looking not only to bring folks back into the fold of the organization, but to bring them back at really a much higher value. The reason for this value is tied to two things. First and foremost is the average gift, but a byproduct of that higher average gift is the number of people who use a credit card. And if you remember, Larry talked about a couple of minutes ago that folks who use a credit card tend to make larger gifts than folks who write you a check. So that's a big dynamic and a big element of telemarketing driving such significant value. So conclusion on this is try expanding the use of telemarketing for lapse recapture. Try calling a little bit deeper in the file. And then, you know, of course, there's other program types that you can use on telemarketing. Larry referenced sustainers. I've got a grid here. Hopefully you guys can see some of the numbers. This data is for a small advocacy organization. Their 0 to 24-month file is about 8,000, 7 or 8,000 donors, so relatively small donor file. They have a decent-sized online activist file. These are the folks who subscribe to their newsletter and take actions and so forth. And they've got about 60,000 of those folks. And what you can see here is that first circled set of numbers is the conversion rate for their donors into a monthly giving program, into a sustainer program. And you can see that number is just under 2.5%, which, you know, all by yourself you might sit there and think, well, that's not very many sustainers, what, you know. But over time, these donors are incredibly valuable. And since these are all credit card donors, their retention rate is incredibly high. What I really want to draw your attention to on this slide are those online activists, the folks at the very bottom. These are folks, as I mentioned, who've taken an action with the organization. They've signed a petition. They've been acquired through some of the acquisition channels that are out in the marketplace. Companies or groups like Change.org and Care2 provide online acquisition services. And you can see the conversion rate of these online activists is really significantly higher, interestingly much higher than we even saw with the donor groups. More than 7% were converting. With, you know, again, a solid average gift, and all of these folks are on credit cards, so really good long-term value on this monthly giving program and the conversion rates. The second set of data here on a sustainer invitation program is actually a very large national organization. This organization has about 3 million 0 to 24-month donors, so really a very different picture. This is a different type of organization altogether. We, in this case, had a lot more data points we could play with. We could look at things like telemarketing responsiveness, presence of a credit card gift. You can see some of those dynamics of the file listed in the segment description in that first bucket. And in this case, what we found, not surprisingly, was that the folks who had made more than two gifts, really 3 to 4 gifts in the last 12 months, folks who had credit card activity on file, folks who had made a telemarketing gift in the past, were really among our best prospects to convert into this monthly giving program. That one big difference between this organization and the data that we all were just looking at a minute or so ago is that this organization has a very low percentage of donors who make gifts on credit card. The small advocacy organization, on a percentage basis, has a higher percentage of donors who make credit card gifts. So you see some differences in data and some advantages and disadvantages of different types of organizations when considering this type of program. So the right mix for each of these organizations ended up being a little bit different by virtue of the level of data we had access to and then how those names performed. You know, so I happen to think telemarketing rules, but there are some guidelines, some rules, if you will, do's and don'ts that are worth following when considering this channel. Absolutely. Use it strategically. Call warm prospects, online activists, petition signers, potentially your volunteers. Those walkers that Larry was talking about who participate in events for health charities, for example, they could be very good prospects for telemarketing conversion. Use it to reinstate donors, deep lapsed, more recently lapsed, as well as to recruit new monthly donors. And don't forget to make it a part of your house file efforts, too, because the more folks you have engaging with you on this channel, the more likely you're going to have a feeder track for things like your monthly giving program. But don't call the phone book. Don't assume that all prospects are the same. And don't assume that just because I shared some data with you from an organization who had a lot of success in converting online activists, that you can just throw up all your online activists on the phones and assume that they're going to convert at the same rate. You've got to analyze. You've got to look at LTV, long-term value, and the return on investment, and make sure that you're matching up the right telemarketing partner with the type of program that you're calling for. There are many, many really extraordinary telemarketing partners out there. In my view, they have different strengths, and so I think it's worth talking to your colleagues and understanding for the type of program that you're launching, who is the right partner for you to work with. So Larry talked some about online a few minutes ago. I'm not going to spend quite as much time, but I think there's a handful of points and sort of easy things that you can do to add a level of integration into your direct response program. the dedicated URLs I have found to be a good source. You know, Larry talked about the percentage of folks who make a gift online after receiving a direct mail piece. He is right on. When we're able to track that data back, what we tend to find are somewhere between 1 and 15% of gifts to a direct mail piece or triggered by a direct mail piece are made to a dedicated direct mail URL. And when I say that, what I'm talking about is, you know, the name of your organization.org/renew or the name of your organization/donate. So that you can track it back. Now, there's of course going to be a large number of people who will not use that dedicated URL, and so having the ability to match back that online giving to your acquisition list or, you know, even to your house file can be really valuable in helping to measure that channel. You know, some organizations several years ago were seeing that fall off in acquisition performance that Larry was alluding to and were able to attribute some of that online revenue to the acquisition program in order to help justify and make the case for continuing their acquisition investment. So it takes a little bit more work. It's definitely a little bit more heavy lifting, but certainly valuable to try to identify those online donors and match them back to the list that you sent the label package to, for example. You know, as we talked about with telemarketing, I think that warm prospects, again, online activists, petition signers, and so forth, they can be very good prospects in your mail program. You do have to watch the results. I've seen some really mixed results on those folks in the mail. Sometimes they convert extraordinarily well. We have one client who uses a free sticker offer on Facebook to drive traffic and to collect those important postal addresses, and then those people get fed into the acquisition program. They happen to convert very, very well. I've seen other organizations try to mail online activists and not have quite the same success. So, again, important to look at that data. Of course, email your online activists with appeal and join and renewal messaging. Again, test telemarketing efforts to online activists. And don't forget that when somebody makes a gift to your organization through your website, through the online channel, that they need to get picked up in your offline communication as well, in your appeals, in your renewals, in your sustainer asks. Just because they first engaged with you through that channel, through online, doesn't mean that's the only place they want to engage with you. And, in fact, mail, telemarketing, all of those are really critical to continuing that relationship with the donor. So, well, what about mobile, right? I mean, it's sort of the new sexy channel. It's the fun kid in the neighborhood. In my view, the channel is still growing up. There was a lot of hubbub about text to give a couple of years ago, especially after the earthquake in Haiti. My sense is that text to give is probably not the silver bullet, but understanding that people use their phones in a very different way than they used them even 2 or 3 years ago. So things like making sure your email is optimized for mobile. I've seen some data that suggests up to 25% of the folks who are reading your email are reading it on their phone. Mobile-optimized donation forms. I think the jury's still out on whether somebody's going to be standing on the subway in New York and making a donation to your organization, but my sense is that time is coming. So get ahead of the curve on that and optimize those donation forms. Use text to support other campaigns. If you have a list of your donors' mobile numbers, obviously if you have their permission, use it to support your year-end effort, your renewal messaging, that kind of thing. Again, there's data to support, in fact, a couple of case studies that I've seen over the last 2 years that really suggest that folks, they may not specifically engage with you or respond to that channel and donate, but that the folks who receive that reminder message, especially, you know, during year-end, for example, are going to remember to then go back home, hop on their computer, and make that donation. And collect mobile numbers. Consider trying them in telemarketing programs. That's a little bit of a radical idea. I have one client who does that and does it actually with pretty significant success. More than 25% of households today no longer have landlines. So this is something that's going to come. Many organizations may not yet be comfortable with it, and even some of our donors might not yet be comfortable with it, but it certainly doesn't hurt now to start collecting that data. And then last but not least, I got a couple of stats for you to remember. Certainly there's not going to be a quiz afterwards, but these are some good points to remember, particularly when having conversations internally at your organization or with your clients for the consultants in the room, if you will. 37% of donors who give online say that when they receive a direct mail piece from a charity, they actually go to the website to make that contribution rather than send it in through the mail. For people in the Gen X and Gen Y age groupings, it's 50%. So, and that's from a study that was done almost 2 years ago by Campbell Rinker. A donor who provides his or her email address to you is somewhere typically between $15 and $50 more valuable to your organization than somebody who does not. The data on mobile numbers with this is still out, I think mostly because a lot of organizations aren't necessarily capturing that information. But I have seen some statistics that somebody who provides you with a mobile number is worth 50% more than somebody who does not. So if you think about it in the context of how you as an individual share information about yourself, the people that you want to stay in touch with, particularly with your mobile number, are people who you're going to have that deeper relationship. And so it makes sense that somebody who provides you with mobile is more valuable because they're more dedicated, they're more interested, they're more engaged in your cause. But last and certainly not least, mail is still responsible for the vast majority of nearly all nonprofits' revenue, direct response revenue. Larry is right on, 95% or more in most cases. So please don't, even though we've got, you know, sexy mobile, we've got sexy email, please don't forget that mail is the guy who brought you to the dance, and we should not forget about him. So thank you. Margaret, do you want to pick it back up?
Oh, I wonder if we've lost Margaret. She was emailing us earlier that she's in Dallas, Texas, and they get a lot of thunderstorms in Dallas.
Oh, and she did. She just IM'd us and said
an issue.
Yep, that she got dropped again.
You know, I just wanted to, Karen, I wanted to add just a thought on what you were just saying. Even if you're a smaller organization, there's so many of these things you could be doing yourself. You know, let's say you're an organization with 1,000 donors. There's no reason that you couldn't try to make 20 calls a day from your office. You know, perhaps get a list of folks who are giving you $100 or more and give them calls just to say thank you or how much you appreciate them, and do it yourself. If someone's just recently this week made a gift with a credit card, why not call them up and say, you know, some of our donors really appreciate giving monthly and it makes it easier for them. Would you be interested in that? I know it's not easy to do. It's kind of like being a cold calling salesman, right? But it's something everyone could do if you wanted to try it. Again, these ideas that Karen's sharing, and I hope some of what I shared, they're not just for big organizations. Anyone can take advantage of a lot of the thoughts here and a lot of other things you're going to hear the big organizations doing.
Yep, Larry, you're right on with the thank you calls. We have a couple of clients who've just started doing this internally, calling folks who've recently joined a particular giving club or even calling folks who've made a gift at a certain level simply to say thank you. And it's amazing. The donors are blown away that the organization has taken the time to say thank you. If the organization doesn't reach somebody, they leave a message. And there's the data hound that I tend to be, there's a significant amount of data out there that suggests those efforts pay for themselves, and typically pay for themselves in droves within about 6 months. So you see increased giving frequency, increased average gifts, particularly as a lead into year-end giving for a lot of organizations, some mostly more so charitable nonprofits. But the thank you calls, it's a simple thing to do in a small organization. You know, pick up the phone, make 20 calls a day or 15 calls a day, and keep that relationship up with your donors. It's really an extraordinary way to use a channel that you might not otherwise consider using to continue to build that relationship and drive additional support for your organization.
You know, I'm with you all the way. Telemarketing, it's history. For me, at least, it's such an ugly stepchild for most organizations. I know no one likes to get telemarketing calls, but it works so well. And the impact on giving, I think you just showed some stats that showed us that folks who are reactivated via the phone have such a higher long-term value. Even folks who get a phone call and don't respond, who say no thank you, have a higher long-term value than people who never got a phone call. And those numbers have been around, believe it or not, and I hate to keep dating myself, from the 1980s. But they're fresh. I just saw Special Olympics speaking at the Bridge Conference also, talking about perceiving the greater long-term value of someone who gets a phone call and doesn't contribute to the phone call. You know, and it started with such a bad rap that it was exclusively used for a long time with lapsed donors, and that was because, you know, the nonprofit could be talked into the idea of harassing their donors on the phone if they hadn't given in a few years. But in fact, it's just a dynamite tool for, you know, higher dollar donors, for converting donors to monthly giving, et cetera. There are organizations now who are using telemarketing to promote planned giving.
Absolutely.
With very great success. And, you know, not all of us might want to make the call to talk with someone about their will, but, you know, with the do not call rules that have gone into effect for quite some time now, people are not getting very many telemarketing calls. It's not the harassing, you know, nightmare it used to be way back when.
That's
and
true.
With most folks having call waiting, they have a real good option to just ignore you. So, you know, picking up the phone or having a telemarketer do a lot of calling for you, extremely productive way to convert donors and get their long-term value boosted.
Larry, this is Margaret. You're talking I'm finally back on. I got thrown off the line. But you're talking about sort of the how telemarketing is a little bit different now, and that's how it's perceived differently. And I'm wondering if, I know that obviously telemarketing calls are scripted. Do you think that it's changing in a way that is giving callers more leeway in being more personable and more personal with the people that they're calling? Because it seems like across the board, the whole idea behind fundraising is really to, you know, to have more of a relationship with your potential donor. Are you seeing that in telemarketing too?
Margaret, I would say absolutely. I think that, you know, a good telemarketer and a good telemarketing partner hires people who know how to do that. You know, they know how to use the script, they know how to use the issues at hand, and build that relationship with the donor. At the end of the day, what all of us do, all of us in this fundraising world, what we're doing is building relationships. And the phones, you've got such an opportunity to have that one-to-one that a good telemarketer, a good telefundraiser has the ability to build that relationship and really make that personal connection and understand that often there's really critical information that they can capture and gather from that interaction, whether it's, to ultimately feed that person into a planned giving contact or convert them to a monthly donor. That one-to-one relationship and that more personal, deeper engagement is critical for the long-term success of a telemarketing program and ultimately retaining that donor within your organization.
Well, and thank you, Karen. We have a few questions specifically about direct mail, and I thought this was an interesting one. Do you think that the Postal Service cutbacks that are resulting in fewer delivery days and slower service will move giving away from the mail? What are you looking at, you know, 5 years down the line or 10 years down the line as far as direct mail?
Larry, you want to take the first stab at that one?
Sure. 10 years down the line, boy. But I tell you, I think...
No pressure. Crystal ball.
I think that direct mail for nonprofits is not going anywhere. I say that with some confidence because change is slow, even though, you know, in many aspects of our life, change is fast. But, for example, the numbers we were looking at, and Karen might have some to share as well, about the percentage of donors using credit cards, that hasn't changed in 10 years. And, you know, all of us live on our credit card, right? I mean, I sent 3 kids through college on my credit card, which is why I fly to, you know, vacations without paying for them. And yet people love to write checks. Direct mail will continue. The Postal Service is not going away. There's no way. And they are going to be more and more dependent on things like nonprofit mail to keep them going. They're now primarily in the business of delivering commercial mail, and that's not going to change. 10 years, I don't know. But I think we've got easy 10 years of direct mail for nonprofits ahead of us.
Yeah, the only thing I would add, I think Larry's right on, the only thing I would add is my best guess is that the biggest impact will be in how we look at cash flow curves, particularly on big mailing. So, your big acquisition drops, your big first renewal drops, that kind of stuff. My sense is that the curve will probably change. I don't know if it's going to get longer or shorter, but if there are fewer delivery days My guess is that's probably the number one impact. But I agree with Larry. I don't think direct mail is going anywhere. I think that there's potential for increased competition in the mailbox, but frankly, we've been dealing with that for years. The number of nonprofits in the last 15 years alone has increased, I think it's like 15-fold or something like that. I mean, the competition is already there, and if you're not trying to figure out how to deal with it today, then you got bigger fish to fry.
Mm. Well, I'm with you all the way. I think that if we get to 5 delivery days rather than 6, you've got just that many more pieces of mail at once, meaning a higher likelihood that you might get ignored and response rates could go down somewhat. And I think right on also with the response curves. Response curves are already much longer than they used to be. And I'm not sure if that's entirely because delivery is slower or because people simply are reacting slower. But I think that's probably a good observation as well.
Do either of you think that there is a great divide in the fundraising sector right now about how people feel about the future of direct mail? I mean, Larry, we had talked before the webinar about the idea that people thinking that direct mail is either going away or is not working as well. Is that a problem that's causing some sort of a divide within the sector?
Yeah, there's a disease in fundraising, and the most obvious symptom is the tendency for nonprofits to think, how can I get some good donors instead of these crappy donors I have now? And it's been a compulsion throughout my career for people to think, why couldn't I be just like that guy over there instead of like who I am? So, yes, I think, you know, everybody always wishes they were doing things better, cheaper, faster. And boards of directors, for example, speak to the fundraising committee and say, why are we doing this direct mail? It's so old-fashioned, nobody responds anymore. Well, you know, the numbers show something else. But, yes, I think you're exactly right.
Yeah,
I would
add that I think that organizations who are looking to the future are – breaking down the silos that exist within organizations on things like online versus offline giving. And that those silos have absolutely existed. I've seen it in lots of organizations. But the ones who are succeeding and the ones who have, frankly, survived this recession that we're in or coming out of or, you know, depending on whose view you look at, you know, still dealing with, that the folks who have moved beyond that siloization of where the money's coming from and is it mail versus, you know, email and so on, the ones who have moved beyond that are the ones who are raising more money and not having a lot of the file size problems and value problems that that organizations have seen over time and have tried to then scapegoat. You know, well, everybody's giving online now, you know, it's or nobody's giving to the mail anymore, everybody's giving online. You know, a lot of those sort of fallacy arguments that hopefully some of the data that we've been able to share today gives folks listening in the ability to some ammunition, if you will, to go back within their organization and figure out how to manage for some of that.
We have some questions that sort of hinge on something that you had said, Larry, during your presentation, that mailing smarter does not automatically mean mailing less. There must be a sweet spot, and some of our attendees would like to know how you figure out what that is. How do you figure out how often to mail your donors?
Oh, boy. That's like a million-dollar question. In today's world, if you're not mailing monthly, you're not mailing enough. You know, once upon a time, you could mail a donor 6 times a year and do pretty well. But if you look at your response rate, let me work backwards from a little math, and I'll do it quickly. You want at least 55 to 60% of the people who made a gift in the last 12 months to make a gift in the next 12 months, at least 55 to 60%, more if you can. If you look at the response rate any time you send them a piece of mail, do the math and figure out how many you have to do to get that to 60%, and it's going to be something along the lines of minimally 9 times, but more likely 12 or more. But then there are so many pockets who get treated different ways that, you know, there's all kinds of ways to slice and dice it, and if you're doing your job right, you're doing that. The other thing I would share with you is from an acquisition perspective, I have never in my career heard someone look back and regret doing more acquisition. You know, that's never the failure that you had was, gee whiz, we just did too much acquisition. acquiring more donors every year. If you could acquire 10% more donors next year than you did this year, you'd be in a good growth path.
Okay. And Karen, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I the only thing I would add is that I don't know that there's a single answer to that question. I think so much of it depends on the organization, what their mail cycle has been, what it could be, what else is in the mix. Is there telemarketing in the mix? Are there events in the mix? Are the donors who you're primarily speaking to direct response acquired or event acquired? And there's all of those elements that need to be considered as you're trying to figure out what that contact strategy looks like over time. Is there cultivation in the mix? Are there newsletters? Are there magazines, et cetera? Generally, I'd say 12 times a year is probably a fair number. Some organizations, I think, can get away with mailing a little bit less frequently. Some organizations are going to require you mail more frequently. I think you have to make decisions about renewal mail versus appeal mail. And if somebody hasn't yet renewed, do you keep them in renewals only, or do you also send them your appeals? Once somebody does renew, do you have an appeals track you can put them into? So there's a lot of those decisions that are very organization specific, but all worth considering. And frankly, if you're an organization who exchanges your file with somebody else, with other organizations, if you're not mailing your donors, somebody else is. And you absolutely don't want for your great donors to stop giving to you and start giving to somebody else. And by the way, that doesn't mean don't exchange or don't rent your file. It just means if that's part of your business model, make sure that you're also talking to your donors.
And then there's also to add into the mix, are there times when, if you're going to mail your donors 12 times a year, how many of those should be asks and how many should be strictly informational? Are there any thoughts on that?
I'm talking about 12 asks. Everything else is in addition to that.
Oh, okay.
And there should be. There should be, other mailings that are newsletters, newsletter-type mailings, planned giving suggestions, sustainer opportunities, et cetera. 12 asks.
I would agree with that.
As Karen says, it could be 9, it could be fewer, but you're losing response.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And even your newsletters, your magazines should include some kind of soft ask. At a minimum, they need to include a return envelope so that if somebody is so inspired to give by the story about the child with a cleft palate that your donation helped repair, you need to make sure they have a vehicle in their hand to respond.
Now, we have a few questions that talk about the expense of mailings. And I know that, during the depths of the recession that we're just, slowly crawling out of, a lot of organizations were their first instinct was to cut back on acquisition because it is so expensive. But I think that they've learned and they've been advised that that's not a good idea. Do you think that organizations are now starting to increase their acquisition efforts again, or do you think that they're still a little bit afraid?
I've seen that for sure. I think people are gradually starting to put their toes back in the water, launching direct response programs, reinvigorating direct response programs that had fallen off. And frankly, the orgs that I've seen getting back in and doing it in a very, strategic, smart way, looking at the data, paying very close attention to what lists they're mailing, working closely with their list brokers and list managers and so forth to really develop smart, good plans, they're having success. I'm seeing file growth again. I'm seeing new donors reengaging in a different way again. And so I think the tides are turning. That may not be true in every single sector just yet, but I'm absolutely seeing movement in that space.
I agree, and I completely understand that there are years, unfortunately, a few years recently when some organizations had to cut back on acquisition. But the absolute fact is that will be a negative blip that will travel through your direct marketing program for years to come. You won't ever get the chance
and take
to have
years
that
to repair.
Exactly. And, on the frequency question, for example, if you're never going to mail – you should never mail anything to your donors that doesn't make money. I mean, it's really hard to do. And if you drop mailing number 9 out of a 12 mailing schedule, mailing number 10 will not get double the response rate.
Mm-hmm.
So there's money that went away that you don't get back.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to cut everybody off, but we are absolutely out of time. Before we go, the link to Dan. Oh, I'm sorry. That's wrong. We are out of time. On behalf of Fundraising Success and InfoGroup Nonprofit Solutions, I want to thank everyone for attending today's webinar. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. Again, thank you very much for attending, and thank you to our speakers.